Chief Judge, Judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. The court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States versus Senior Airman Caleb S. Garcia. Miscellaneous docket number 2019-07. In today's oral argument, we consider whether the military judge abused her discretion in suppressing the appellee's DNA. Government counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. We request to reserve 5 minutes.
Very well. You may proceed.
Chief Judge Johnson, members of the court, I'm Captain Kelsey Schust, and along with Colonel Speranza, we represent the United States. A search that is conducted pursuant to a warrant is presumptively reasonable. The trial judge in this case abused her discretion because she failed to apply this basic tenet of Fourth Amendment law. Instead, following the February 2019 search suppression, the trial judge erroneously viewed the October 2019 search in a grudging and negative way that is inconsistent with the Fourth Amendment. This court should find the trial judge abused her discretion in suppressing the appellee's DNA, reverse the trial judge's decision, and find testimony regarding appellee's DNA is admissible in his pending trial for sexually assaulting Airman J.L.
Counsel, at some point in your argument, I'd like you to address, doesn't have to be now, the issue of portions of Mr. M.T.'s report that reference, I think quite clearly, all parties would agree, matters that were suppressed in the first suppression hearing. What, if anything, this court would do about that?
Yes, Your Honor, and I'm happy to address that point now. In order to find the evidence admissible regarding appellee's DNA, this court does not need to find that the report in and of itself has to be admissible in total. The government has an ability to admit evidence in line with the first suppression from February 2019 by simply just relying on testimony from Mr. M.T. or relying on a redacted version of the report. Mr. M.T. was very clear in his testimony in the Article 39A session that his previous analysis did not affect the second analysis that he did because he only needed the reference sample to complete the analysis. Now, before we move into the specific abuses of discretion in the trial judge's ruling, I'd like to take a step back and recall some of the basic facts from the October 2019 search authorization. These are suspicious facts that were available to the authorizing judge regarding Airman JL's memory, the appellee's motive and opportunity, and Airman JL's vaginal swab from her sexual assault nurse examination. The authorizing judge in October 2019 had information available to him about Airman JL's memory, that she reported that she woke up halfway through the night in the spare bedroom with appellee on top of her, that she, in her own words, said that he was trying to have sex with her, that she asked who it was, and he said his name, providing his identity. And she was pretty sure that he actually did have sex with her. In the morning, he got mad when he told her to shower, and then she refused. In addition, the search affidavit from October 2019 has facts about Apelli's motive and opportunity. Airman CG reported that Apelli was alone with Airman JL for 10 to 20 minutes that night. And Airman CG also reported that Apelli indicated he had a sexual interest in Airman JL and wanted to have a threesome. Finally, the evidence presented, yes, Your Honor.
So one of the questions I have is, going back to the shower discussion that you had, that's in the record, can you help this court understand what facts are in the record allows this court or the judge that made the ruling to connect the prior sexual assault that was at some point being discussed in the spare bedroom and why JL would or might have or why the magistrate perhaps might rely on that information so that the shower behavior would suddenly seem suspicious as opposed to the arguments, I guess, the ruling by the judge that talked about this being because she smelled like beer or something along those lines.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's really a factual question. What's in the record that talks about that?
Appendix B, which is attached to the government's appeal, is the affidavit in support of the search, and that contains a paragraph citation to the fact that the appellee was already under investigation for sexual assault, and that's at paragraph 4H on page 27 of Appendix B, which is also Appellate Exhibit 57. And there's also some indication that earlier that night, prior to anything happening in the bedroom, the appellee, Senior Airman CG, and Airman JL had all been talking about the fact that he was under investigation. So that is evidence that this court can rely on to explain Airman JL's suspicion that the reason that appellee wanted her to take a shower was because he was trying to get rid of evidence. He was already under investigation for a sexual assault. Based on all of these suspicious facts, based on all of this information, a separate, neutral, and detached military judge made a common sense judgment that probable cause existed and authorized seizure of appellee's DNA. But the trial judge in this case erroneously suppressed appellee's DNA. And she did so and abused her discretion when she erroneously applied the law related to three key analyses. First, material and reckless affidavit omissions. Second, probable cause. And third, independent source doctrine analysis. Now, Your Honors, I'd like to turn first to probable cause because it's the most egregious example of the trial judge's abuse of discretion. Because even if we assume the October 2019 affidavit was created with a design to mislead the authorizing judge or made in reckless disregard of whether it would mislead the authorizing judge, the trial judge in this case misapplied the standard for probable cause under the law. And her ruling applies a hyper-technical, mathematical standard that both the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces have warned against. And I'll point the court to specific references in the military judge's ruling. When we look at paragraph 63, which is in Appellate Exhibit 59, the trial judge erroneously finds that probable cause can't exist when there are other alternate theories for events. She says that the additional facts that Senior Airman CG admitting to having sexual intercourse with Airman JL and the fact that Airman JL was in a relationship with her boyfriend would have extinguished probable cause. That's the trial judge's language. So in her view, if other explanations exist, they must extinguish probable cause. But the law reflects that probable cause is not a zero-sum game. Just because an alternate explanation exists doesn't mean that it extinguishes all of the other possible explanations, because they can coexist. Kaff in United States versus Bethea explains this in a mathematical context, because the court notes that even though people use the terminology probable cause is not a mathematical standard that requires more than 50%.
Counsel, did you say Mejia?
Bethea, yes, Your Honor.
Bethea. I'm familiar with the case. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. Bravo, Echo, Tango, Hotel, Echo, Alpha. In that case, the court found that even though there is alternate explanations that exist, that doesn't mean that another alternate explanation is altogether extinguished, because they can coexist. One can even be more likely than the other, but if there is enough suspicion for the first example, the first explanation to exist, then that's enough to meet the low bar of probable cause. The military judge clearly misapplies her understanding of what can constitute probable cause. And she also does not adhere to law from the Supreme Court when she finds that the government has an obligation to rule out all of the other suspicious facts that the military judge believed were omitted. The District of Columbia v. Westby is a Supreme Court case from 2018 where the court says that probable cause does not require officers to rule out a suspect's innocent explanation for suspicious facts. All that matters and the focus of the inquiry is on the suspicious facts themselves. There is no obligation for the government to present the entirety of its case in order to get a search affidavit.
Counsel, are there any cases within our jurisdiction that allude to exactly what you're talking to, that focuses on the suspicious facts themselves?
Your Honor, I believe Bethea also is a case that has some language directing courts to focus on an inquiry of not what is criminal or non-criminal conduct, but what effectively is suspicious behavior. In addition, the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces in both Mason and Figueroa have relied on a Fourth Circuit case, United States versus Coakley, which also includes very strong language about the fact that there is no obligation to expressly rule out innocent explanations for suspicious facts as part of a probable cause determination. The second place that the military judge demonstrates her abuse of discretion and her erroneous application of probable cause is in paragraph 63 as well, when she determines that there is no probable cause because the government presented no evidence of penetration by the accused. Now, the affidavit and the suspicious facts that were presented were enough to give rise to a reasonable suspicion of penetration. The search affiant is not required to present evidence of penetration to the same degree that one would have to present evidence of an element at trial. That's not what the law requires. Illinois versus Gates is the Supreme Court decision that says that probable cause requires only a fair probability and not a prima facie showing that evidence of a crime will be found in a particular place. All of these standards reflect the fact that the purpose of seeking a search affidavit from the very beginning is to continue a government investigation to determine what should happen and if a crime actually occurred. Courts ask not whether that conduct is innocent or guilty when they're trying to determine probable cause. The probable cause and the reason for the search is to determine what evidence is out there at all from the very beginning. So it's irrelevant that Airman J.L. doesn't know whether penetration occurred when you consider the entire list of suspicious facts that suggest a fair probability that she, in fact, was sexually assaulted that night by a appellee. She woke up halfway through the night with a stranger on top of her. She believed that he was having sex with her. She was pretty sure he was having sex with her. His friend put him in the room alone with her for 10 to 20 minutes, and he told his friend that he wanted to have a threesome with her. Not to mention the fact that he was already under investigation for a separate sexual assault, and also that OSI opened up an investigation into him specifically because Airman J.L. reported something to her first sergeant to indicate that she believed Apelli had sexually assaulted her.
Does it matter? How much does it matter that she was aware of other sexual assault allegations? I mean, what is the magistrate supposed to do with that information?
Your Honor, that information was provided to the magistrate because the case law shows that the fact that another individual is under investigation can also be part of the circumstances in the totality of circumstances that give rise to probable cause.
So is the significance that it was presented to the magistrate? Is that really where it affects probable cause and it doesn't really matter so much whether she knew it or not?
Your Honor, both of the facts that it was presented to the magistrate and also that Airman J.L. knew it explains the totality of the circumstances of the evidence here.
The fact that Airman J.L. knew it tend to lead her to jump to conclusions that perhaps you know, as to what might have happened, even if she can't remember being penetrated by the appellee in this case?
Your Honor, Airman Jail's knowledge that the appellee was already under investigation could be a reason for her to be suspicious of his behavior, but that also doesn't discount her very assertive belief from even the very first interview that she woke up to appellee on top of her. He said it was him. He said his name, and she recognized his voice. So it's a fact that might be considered, but it doesn't discount the entirety of the facts that also establish that she had a belief that the appellee sexually assaulted her. And her belief was not the only reason and was not the only evidence that was provided to the authorizing judge to establish probable cause. Her evidence of her being alone with him in the bedroom was corroborated by Senior Airman CG and was also corroborated by the fact that a vaginal swab recovered from her showed not just Airman CG, but also another male individual's DNA profiles on that sample.
Counsel, one quick question before we move on. It's a bit puzzling. And obviously, we'll stay within the record, but there's certainly information that is regulatory, if you will, about how DNA is collected from individuals that are under investigation, either at the referral stage, referral stage, or investigative stage. It's somewhat puzzling that given that regulatory information that appellant's DNA wouldn't already be in a database because he was already under investigation. I think charges had even been preferred on the other individual. So it seems like the government already had his DNA, and it's a little bit puzzling to try to work through that regulatory understanding besides whatever the facts may be in this case. I don't know if that was litigated at the trial level. Do you have any thoughts on that? Any comments?
Your Honor, I don't believe that issue was litigated at trial, but the purpose of collecting appellee's DNA a second time pursuant to a warrant was that the government recognized he had a reasonable expectation of privacy over that DNA that they needed to collect lawfully in order to be admissible at court. In sum, the trial judge probable cause analysis in this case is an abuse of discretion because it applies a standard for probable cause that's unreasonable and contrary to well-established tenets of Fourth Amendment law. If this court were to accept the trial judge's hyper-technical requirement for a victim to be able to recall actual penetration in every case, then the government is going to be left in a position where the government is unable to seek evidence in many cases because, unfortunately, many cases involve victims who are incapable of consenting, unconscious or otherwise unaware of what's happening, and unable to report exactly that penetration occurred. That's the exact type of case where the government needs this evidence and needs to know whether there is evidence of a sexual assault that can be recovered. And the government needs to be able to recover that through a probable cause determination that's reasonable, not hyper-technical. Turning to the second way the trial judge in this case, erroneously applied the law and abused her discretion, we can look to her analysis for material and reckless omissions because her determination that Agent RD's actions were reckless were based on an erroneously applied standard for recklessness that's inconsistent with MRE 311D4B, which incorporated Franks versus Delaware and was extended to omissions by CAF. The trial judge made a finding of fact that Agent RD was reckless, but she made that finding of fact based on her erroneous application of what constitutes recklessness under the law. The trial judge did not require the level of flagrant conduct that CAF said in United States versus Cowgill is required to distinguish conduct that is merely negligent and thus not a violation, with conduct that is reckless and violates the law.
This agent said that he had a practice of basically ignoring whatever history was given during the sexual assault forensic exams. So he would take receipt of a report that has the victim's statement about the events, and then would just purposely exclude that from his consideration whenever seeking search authorizations. having a practice like that not be, by definition, reckless?
Your Honor, that agent's practice is not particularized to a set of facts or to a case that he's working. It is his general practice. And here, it's not just a requirement that an agent's conduct generally has to be reckless, but that the agent's misconduct specifically is made with a reckless disregard of whether it would mislead the search authority or the authorizing judge, or whether it was designed to mislead the authorizing judge. Here, we know he didn't have that level of mens rea. He didn't have that recklessness that's required because he did it in every case. He didn't try to intentionally mislead this authorizing judge because that was his normal practice.
Well, couldn't it be reckless even if he does it in every case? If he was aware that the alleged victim had told the nurse that she remembered things substantially differently from what she told the OSI, wouldn't it be reckless to ignore that, either one direction or the other?
Your Honor, it could potentially be reckless, but that also depends on the entirety of the rest of the investigation, because the court has to apply a totality of the circumstances analysis to determine whether the information is not only intentionally or recklessly omitted, but also whether it's material. And the language that 311D4B uses is whether it's necessary to a finding of probable cause.
And counsel, not to shift gears on you too much, but I would like to ask you about something that the agent did put in the affidavit, which in the affidavit, certain lines are bolded and underlined. And one of the things that he bolded and underlined was his own question saying, was it just vaginal intercourse? And then it goes on to say, not bolded or underlined, was there any, like, anal intercourse or anything like that? And the response is, not that I don't think so. Can you think of a good reason for the agent to have underlined and bolded that particular part of his own question?
Your Honor, I can't think of necessarily a good reason for the agent to have underlined his own question other than potentially a lack of attention to detail in the way that he wrote that particular or underlined that particular phrase.
Do you think it was a mistake at best?
Your Honor, I agree that it's a mistake at best, and Franks versus Delaware is very clear that mere negligence is not sufficient to amount to recklessness that is going to defeat a lawful, presumptively reasonable search affidavit. We know from the record that the agent in this case did not act recklessly, because even the facts that the military judge, the trial judge, determined were omitted were included on the face of the affidavit. She relied on his omission that that Senior Airman CG's had sexual intercourse with Airman JL, but that's on the face of the affidavit. She relied on an omission that Airman JL's was inconsistent in recalling her state of address, but that's also on the face of the affidavit. We know that the agent in this case reviewed the entire case file. He reviewed the evidence himself. He submitted a draft affidavit to the legal office for review. The legal office suggested making additions, and then he again reviewed those suggested additions to make sure that they matched with the evidence that he had. This is not the actions or the behavior of an agent who has a design to mislead the search authority. He's not acting recklessly. In fact, he's doing everything he can to comply with the Fourth Amendment and the military judge's February 2019 suppression ruling.
So are you saying that the judge's finding was clearly erroneous on this point, or are you saying the judge misapplied the law on this point?
Your Honor, the judge did not understand what the law requires for a finding of recklessness. So to the extent that she made a determination that the agent acted recklessly, that is a incorrect or misapplication of the law. But also, because it is a finding of fact and there is plenty of evidence to show that that is not supported by the record, it is also clearly erroneous. It's clear from the military judge's analysis regarding material and reckless omissions that she is framing her analysis based on a negative and grudging perspective from the February 2019 search. And you can look at the quotations in her ruling at Appellate Exhibit 59, paragraph 56 and 63, where she indicates that one of the primary issues in the first search authorization was the fact that the agent told the search authority falsely that Airman Jail was wearing clothes, and then it was even more important for the government to accurately reflect the state of dress in the second request. And the government knew that they needed to provide the complete picture to the search authority. This shows that the military judge is not operating from a position of presumptive reasonableness. She is considering the face of the affidavit, the evidence presented, in light of the February 2019 search. And that is not the proper frame of analysis for the Fourth Amendment. Military judge abused her discretion as it relates to material and reckless omissions because she determined that the agent's actions were reckless based on her erroneously applied standard for recklessness that's inconsistent with the law. With your Honor's permission, I'd like to address the independent source doctrine abuses of discretion during rebuttal.
Very well. Appellee's counsel, you may proceed.
Good afternoon, Chief Judge Johnson, members of the court. May it please the court. I'm Captain Deidre Campbell, and along with my co-counsel, Mr. Mark Brueger, we represent the appellee, Senior Airman Caleb Garcia. The military judge did not abuse her discretion in granting the defense's suppression motion. Her decision to apply the exclusionary rule was appropriate for two primary reasons. First, the search was based on a false and reckless affidavit, and a corrected affidavit would not support probable cause. Second, the good faith, inevitable discovery, and independent source doctrines do not apply. So turning first to whether there was a false and reckless affidavit, it's important to consider that the crux of the military judge's finding on this issue is that Special Agent RD cherry-picked facts and failed to present a complete picture to the search authority. The omissions are all crucial on their own, but it's important to consider how they're connected and distort the picture presented to the search authority. The agent misled the search authority, giving an impression that Senior Airman Garcia unequivocally had sex with JL and is the only person who could be the third source of DNA. Citing a Ninth Circuit federal case, United States versus Perkins, in that case, the agent's actions are very similar to what the agent did in this case. The court found that the agent, in his actions, it was clear and intentional, there was a clear and intentional pattern of the agent selectively and including info bolstering probable cause, and he failed to present a full story and manipulated the inferences the magistrate would draw. And that's exactly what happened in this case.
But didn't the affidavit that Special Agent RD submitted, it mentioned sexual intercourse with Senior Airman CG?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, I can address that point first. So that, in that, for that particular omission, there's a couple of things. So the agent omitted the entire first interview by Airman CG.
Wasn't it cumulative, as the government points out in their brief? Or what was so special about that first interview that it was insufficient to just cite the second?
Yes, Your Honor. So the second interview contained all helpful facts to the government, while the first interview contained a lot of unhelpful facts and facts that would have changed the probable cause landscape.
Which is?
To go through them, Your Honor, the second interview places Airman Garcia alone in the room with JL for 10 to 20 minutes. Second, it gives Airman Garcia's discussion or prompting to have a threesome, also his desire to have sex with JL. It mentions that Airman CG had sex with JL, but it provides no context. The affidavit is also silent on the fact that JL did not remember having sex.
Okay, so that's the second, but what about the first interview?
The first interview that was omitted, that was the first subject interview of Airman CG. So in that interview, he's read his rights, and he admits to having sex with JL. He describes in detail his one-on-one interactions with her in the same bedroom where Airman JL believes, where JL believes Airman Garcia assaulted her. So he puts himself alone with JL for several times throughout the night, including falling asleep in the bedroom with her. And JL has no memory of that. And then second, he also only put Airman Garcia alone in the room for 1 to 2 minutes in that first interview. And there's no mention of a threesome. There's no mention of Airman Garcia wanting to have sex with JL. And then to contrast that with the second interview, in that second interview, that's after he knows he's under investigation. He's had time to reflect on that, and he provides conflicting information in regards to Airman Garcia's opportunity and desire to have sex with JL. And it's also not clear that, again, the context and how much time he spent alone in that room with JL, which she has no memory of. Your Honor, so just to briefly summarize some of the other omissions by the military judge, she describes omissions regarding the state of dress and also information that JL does not remember, or that JL was living with her ex-boyfriend at the time. And before I get into the rest of those omissions, I just want to touch on, Chief Johnson, you had mentioned the underlying of some of the statements by the agent. Those clearly were not mistakes. Those were deliberate intentions by the agent to draw the magistrate to the conclusion that penetration occurred. And as the government had pointed out, the agent had went back and forth with the legal office. The fact that the agent had the affidavit reviewed by the legal office should be given little weight under the facts of this case. This is the same legal office that OSI went through the first time, and they were told to keep false information in an affidavit, or in an affidavit they were provided to the search authority.
Can I ask you about the significance of that first affidavit? It was signed, I believe, after the search was actually executed. If I understand the facts correctly, the affiant determined that there was incorrect statements that she had given to the search, or to the magistrate over the phone, and then just kept the affidavit as it was written, and then had then presented that to considering that sequence of events, does it really matter what was in the affidavit when it was signed after the search had already been executed?
Your Honor, I think the most important aspect is that they knew there was false information in there, and they never brought that to the search authority. They never corrected that information, never did anything to rectify the fact that they had false information. Regarding the conclusory statements, the other big aspect of that, it kind of goes with the overall theme of presenting this distorted picture to the magistrate. It's a concerted effort by the agent to lead the search authority to the conclusion that penetration occurred.
Was the agent cross-examined and confronted with that at the suppression hearing?
No, Your Honor.
How does the military judge reach that conclusion without confrontation?
Your Honor, I think through some of the other omissions, and in particular, the agent's testimony regarding statement made to the SANE, I think there's other testimony in the record on other omissions that illustrate the overall intent by the agent. So in turning to the state of dress of JL, The agent knew how important that information was. Again, because of the first search, that's the information they got wrong. And then also just the nature of the allegation in this case.
When you say state address, are you talking about the, there's three incidents. There was the, according to JL, wakes up, the incident in question occurs. Second occasion is wakes up 3 or 4 in the morning, the shower incident occurs. Third incident, she's coming out of the room with the appellant, they're watching a movie or something along those lines. So which state of address, or all three of the state of addresses, are you addressing now?
Your Honor, I'll address the statement to the same first, but just generally, hitting on all of those omissions, they all go towards to painting an incomplete picture of her state of dress. But first, focusing on her clothing at the moment that JL wakes up and sees Airman Garcia. Her clothing at that point in time was critical. She doesn't remember penetration, and if she had clothes on, that changes the probable cause landscape. So not only was the agent on notice of how important it was to get this right, he also acknowledged the importance of providing this information to the search authority. At 4:27 in the record, he was specifically asked about this by defense counsel, and he agreed that he probably did not provide a complete picture. He gave an innocent explanation of why he didn't do that. And Judge Key, kind of getting to your point, that explanation was just not plausible. Regardless of whether he did that in every case, it's disingenuous to believe that if there was helpful information to a probable cause determination, that he would not have included that in the affidavit. Also, just considering the manner in which he answered that question, when defense counsel asked him if he agreed that he didn't provide a complete picture to the search authority, there's a pause captured in the record, and then the agent stutters to answer the question. And when he does, he provides that explanation. And this is different than some of the other cases. In particular, I'll cite to United States versus Cole. The agent provided an explanation that she didn't believe that the information she omitted was relevant to probable cause. There's no testimony like that from the agent. He acknowledges how important the information is. And the military judge is not bound by his innocent explanation. In United States versus Perkins, the Ninth Circuit 2017 case, the court found that the district court erred in accepting the agent's innocent explanation because it wasn't plausible. The military judge should be afforded deference, and the agent's testimony and how he answered the question on this particular point demonstrates why that's important.
Counsel, just so we're clear, you're talking about the point of his testimony that goes in effect that in a certain percentage of cases he has included the issue from the same, but he largely ignores the same's report. Is that what you're referring to? His explanation, the pause that occurred during the part of the record trial?
Yes, Your Honor. So just to clarify just a little bit, his response was that he normally doesn't provide that information in the report. So the pause is right before he provides his explanation. And the record also captures him stuttering to answer the question. So a pause followed by stuttering to answer. The omission of the statement to the same, where JL said her clothes were on, was more than just mere negligence.
That portion of the same's report was 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning when she was taking a shower, not the quote-unquote penetration event if it happened. That is the question. Because the same says, patient states that her clothing was on when she woke up at 0300. So that's the shower incident, not the alleged penetration.
Your Honor, my understanding, it's at the time of the alleged penetration, the affidavit provides information of the timing, but in her second interview, she clarifies that she's unsure of when she woke up. So the timing that she provides is off based on her interview. But the same report states that when her clothes were on when she woke up to Airman Garcia.
I don't think she's ever, we'll have to check the record, but I didn't recall her ever saying that her clothes were definitely on when she woke up to the incident in question. She was uncertain. At one point, I think the record suggests that she was not clothed from the waist down, perhaps.
Your Honor, that comes from her second interview on the 5th of February, where she stated that when she woke up, her shirt was on and she was unsure if she had anything else on. But during her safe exam is when she made the statement to the SANE that her clothes were on when she woke up to Airman Garcia.
At 3 in the morning, before the shower.
Yes, Your Honor. Another omission detailed by the military judge is the fact that Jael was living with Airman ZB, her ex-boyfriend. So the agents omitted that information from the affidavit, and the importance of that is that it gave the impression that Airman Garcia could have been the only source of the DNA. And that's problematic for a couple of reasons. The agent, legal office, government, they already knew the DNA results when they put together this affidavit. They didn't provide any other possible explanation for the third source of DNA. And they withheld information that they had and knew at the time that they failed to provide to the search authority.
So, counsel, the fact that she was living with her ex-boyfriend, that might provide a potential other source of the DNA, but that doesn't extinguish appellee as a potential source of the DNA, does it?
No, Your Honor.
So is the omission of that relevant to show what the agent's state of mind was, or is it, how much does it actually affect the probable cause here?
Your Honor, it goes to the agent's state of mind, that's number one, but it's also very important for the probable cause determination, especially in view of once you have a complete picture of what happened. This is not the case where JL unequivocally understands that she was penetrated by Airman Garcia. And looking at a corrected affidavit, it's important to consider her perception of what happened. And there's a lot of things that could influence that. Your Honor, you brought up the fact that she knew there was a conversation about the fact that he was undergoing a sexual assault allegation. There's a lot of things that could have influenced her thought process and to jump to the conclusion that Airman Garcia penetrated her. She has no memory of penetration. It's not even quite clear that he was on top of her. She asserts that in her first interview, that she woke up and he's on top of her. In her second interview, she states that he was slightly to the side. She has no other memory about that interaction. It's a very limited memory. She was very intoxicated. She doesn't remember if her clothes were on. She makes a statement that her clothes were on. So she has a very distorted perception memory of what happened. And in light of that, along with the other facts that we get from Airman CG, especially if we get the first interview, is that Airman Garcia had very little time, little opportunity to sexually assault JL. He's alone in the room with her for 1 to 2 minutes before he comes out clothed. So taking her distorted memory and putting it up against a corrected affidavit with all the facts, it...
But counsel, CG presumably was sleeping that night at some point. I mean, we have two witnesses that are sleeping. Three people in this apartment. Presumably some were sleeping while other activity was taking place.
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't think that's an unreasonable inference. Or is it?
Your Honor, the way in which CG describes, when he puts Airman Garcia alone in the room with JL, it's when they're all going to sit down and watch a movie. So that's the time period he puts her alone in the room. There's also testimony from JL and Airman CG that at the end of the night, the two of them are sleeping on the couch together. So aside from that, and the information we have from JL on what she did and the parts she does remember, and also Airman CG, at a minimum, there's a major shift in the landscape of probable cause when we add in that corrected information from the first interview.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you sort of a structural question about how the sort of the different doctrines fit together here. So if we assume for purposes of argument that we find the agent was reckless or intentional with regard to what he did or didn't put in the affidavit or present, if we nevertheless, putting in the things that the military judge thought should be there and taking out the things that she thought shouldn't be there, if we still found probable cause at that point, wouldn't the government prevail regardless of other factors at that point?
No, Your Honor. So at that point, the independent source doctrine would come into play. Even if there's probable cause for the second search, we're still dealing with tainted evidence from the first search. It's the same exact evidence, and the only way this would end up coming in is if the government obtained it independently through a third source.
If you could address that, how is it tainted?
Yes, Your Honor. So it's tainted just by the mere fact it's the same exact evidence. So the question is whether that taint has been removed or if the government has obtained it independently through a third source. So in looking at the warrant itself, Murray would be the case on point, and whether the agents were influenced to seek a search authorization, that second search authorization, if knowledge of the results impacted their decision to seek a search authorization.
Don't we already know that they wanted a buccal swab from Appellee because they got one in the first place, and the reason they got another one wasn't because they knew what the DNA result was, but can't we infer it was because the first one was suppressed?
Your Honor, at the time of the first search, they had presented the false information, and then following that first search, they knew they had the false information in the affidavit and didn't correct it. They did not have probable cause at the time of that first search. So then the question becomes, and this case is different than what happened in Murray, because the agents waited until the evidence was suppressed. They closed out their investigation. The agent testified at the suppression hearing that the only reason they sought the second search authorization is because the evidence had been suppressed.
Is that the taint?
Yes.
Is that unlawful behavior by law enforcement?
Yes, Your Honor, because it's there's no way to distinguish that they weren't motivated to obtain this second search authorization because they knew the results. In Murray, just to show the distinction between what happened in that case, and Holloway is also, even though it was ultimately upheld on inevitable discovery, the actions of the agents were completely different in those cases.
Could you say that again? Holloway?
Holloway, Your Honor. In Murray, the agents did the unlawful entry, and then they stopped, and they sought a search authorization. They didn't seize the bales and send them off for testing and wait until the evidence was excluded. The court ultimately didn't decide the question of whether the agents were motivated by what they had seen in the illegal search, and they did not include any information from the illegal search in the affidavit. But it certainly would have been a different scenario had they waited months down the road to seek a search authorization, and that's what we have here. Also, in Holloway, a case by this court, the agent did an illegal search in a dorm room, seized evidence, And then they realized shortly afterwards that they had done an illegal search. They actually didn't have a search warrant. So then they took measures to protect against tainting witnesses. They made sure they didn't use that evidence when they questioned witnesses, and they ultimately learned about the information they seized through a third independent witness. Here in this case, even though they knew they had false information in an affidavit, failed to correct it, they didn't hold on to the evidence, they sent it off, they tested it, they learned the results, they knew those results, and it wasn't until the evidence was suppressed that they sought a search authorization.
Isn't one thing that's different about this case, though, with that passage of time, is during the passage of time, the forensics exam kit taken from the victim in the case was tested, and the results came back indicating that there was sperm from two males. And I believe they had already identified that CG was the contributor for one of them, and then the other one, which we know from the first search, because the swabs that were taken from Pelly, that he was the contributor for the second one. Setting that aside, because that first search of Pelly was suppressed, we're left with the results from that forensic exam, which show two male sperm, one of which is CG and one which is unknown. Given that, wouldn't that drive law enforcement to continue trying to determine who is the contributor of that second sample?
Your Honor, I think it's too speculative in this case. They learn the results simultaneously, and there's no telling what they would have done. The agent had testified they would have continued to seek search authorization, but he had never had search authorization denied, wasn't aware of that happening. And second of all, it's important to consider how the agent's steps were shaped throughout the investigation because of the information they knew. It's entirely possible and probably what would have happened is that when they learned that there was a third source of DNA, they would have at least done some follow-up through at least an interview with JL or other witnesses to determine if anybody else could be the potential source. JL had already disclosed that she was living with her ex-boyfriend. They never even asked her that question because they already knew the results of the test. And I think also too, Your Honor, in the way that they've crafted their affidavit and, you know, again, highlighting the conclusory statements and taking such great care to try to get to probable cause surrounding the penetration, which they knew was problematic, it's also reasonable for the judge to determine that that wouldn't have been a driving factor. So I think ultimately it's just too speculative to assume that they would have applied for a warrant when they learned that there was a third source of DNA, and they did not do that here either. I mean, they still...
Isn't there evidence in the record that CG himself was under investigation and maybe even charged with preferred or referred against him at this point?
Yes, Your Honor. It appears that he was also charged as well.
Now, maybe this is inevitable discovery, but it's hard for me to fathom that at his trial, a trial would take place when only one of two male contributors are known. Wouldn't inevitably there have been either the government itself or CG's counsel seeking to know the source of that other male contributor?
Your Honor, not if they're, this is one of the military judge had determined that JL's boyfriend or ex-boyfriend provided a reasonable explanation for that third source of DNA. So if the agent believed that the boyfriend, based on information that they had, could have been the third source, it's just not entirely clear that they would have taken steps to continue to seek search authorization when it had been denied before.
Wouldn't the reasonable investigative step have been to try and figure out which, if either of these two possible contributors was the actual contributor, as opposed to just throwing up their hands and saying we just can't know?
Your Honor, it's entirely possible, but I think also just in looking at the steps that the agents did take in this case, and especially not even taking the care to correct the false information in the first affidavit and closing out their investigation before they even sought the second authorization is indicative of what they would have done. And Your Honor, I see I'm close to expiring on time. Pending further questions, I'd like to briefly conclude.
Counsel, I do have one question. The judge's ruling, we may need to extend, if I may take a little bit, perhaps extend time. The question may be quite lengthy, but the judge's ruling and the cross in the suppression hearing focused on Special Agent RD's failure to include the information from the SANE report. Yet, when the judge issued her written ruling, as best I can tell, that's the first time that she issued her ruling, and it wasn't done on the record, per se. It wasn't spoken on the record. Nevertheless, the judge seemed to add at least five other grounds for which she found omissions or deliberate omissions that, as far as I can tell from the reading of the record, was never discussed during the suppression hearing. Confrontation of RD, and yet she found RD, Special Agent RD, had made deliberate omissions or false statements, whatever the case may be. Is that erroneous, or is that acceptable?
No, Your Honor. The military judge was presented with the information. She was presented, and a lot of where her findings came from was the ROI that was provided to her. And other information, the SANE report. So she was presented with that information, and it's not erroneous for her to consider what's presented to her and make additional findings aside from what's raised by counsel. In conclusion, the military judge correctly found the facts in this case do not support probable cause. This court should find that the military judge did not abuse her discretion in suppressing Senior Airman Garcia's DNA.
Thank you. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, I'd first like to address some of the appellee's points about probable cause, because I think the appellee's argument has demonstrated the exact problem with a hyper-technical reading of a search affidavit that the military judge runs into in her ruling. It is inconsistent with the Fourth Amendment requirement, where the touchstone is reasonableness, to ask courts and counsel to litigate probable cause as if they're litigating trial. Probable cause is not the same standard that's used at trial. CAF in United States versus Leedy says that the evidence presented in support of a search need not be sufficient to support a conviction. Yet, appellee's argument has demonstrated that that's exactly what the military judge has tried to require, evidence supporting a conviction, not evidence supporting a fair probability or a reasonable suspicion that the evidence from appellee will be evidence of a crime that the government can then use at trial. The military judge disregarded the fact that a separate authorizing, neutral, and detached judge found probable cause based on all of the suspicious facts that were available to him. And all of the other facts that the military judge determined to have been intentionally omitted or disregarded or omitted with a reckless disregard do not change that baseline calculation of probable cause, because they are cumulative and immaterial to a finding of probable cause. When we turn to the final piece of analysis, where the military judge clearly abuses her discretion and look to independent source doctrine, we can see that the crux of the military judge's abuse of discretion is her clearly erroneous finding of fact that the government pursued the October 2019 search only because of the evidence that the government had from the February 2019 search. The military judge makes this conclusion in paragraph 74 of her ruling, where she says the government decision to seek a new search authorization was prompted by the information gathered during the prior search, and but for the illegal search identifying the appellee as a DNA contributor, that nothing indicates that Airman J.L. and appellee were sexually intimate. Your Honors, this is an arbitrary, fanciful, erroneous finding of fact, given the state of the record and all of the other evidence available to establish probable cause regarding Airman J.L.'s memory of waking up with someone on top of her who she could not rule out was vaginally penetrating her, who was in the room alone with her for 10 to 20 minutes, who had expressed interest in having a sexual relationship with her, and whose DNA potentially could be the third source of DNA on the vaginal sample or the second unknown male sample. The trial judge's ruling effectively suggests that the government can never independently seize the appellee's DNA again after the February 2019 search was suppressed. But we know that even if a rights violation under the Fourth Amendment occurs, that the automatic result is not exclusion of that evidence. Here, we know that all of the other facts available show that the exclusion would have independently resulted, that the evidence would have been independently found and was independently found, irrespective of the information gained from the February 2019 search. If this court upholds the military judge's exclusion and suppression, then the government is effectively left in a worse position than the government would otherwise be in because the evidence supported a determination of probable cause. And the goal of the exclusionary rule, we know from Nix versus Williams, is that the government should not be left in a worse position based on evidence that the government otherwise could have lawfully obtained. The goal of the Fourth Amendment is to conduct a reasonable analysis and to protect someone's rights and reasonable expectation of privacy, but not to go so far and to cut so deep as to exclude evidence the government would otherwise lawfully have obtained. Here, we know that the military judge put the government between a rock and a hard place, and we'd have to look no further than her reliance on the fact that the information regarding Mr. MT and his statement that it was an unknown individual was false. It was intentionally false. Because the government had an obligation not to provide his identity. The government was basically sanctioned for not including his identity and not providing his identity because the military judge determined that that was false. I see that I'm out of time, but if I may briefly conclude, Your Honor.
Briefly.
Yes, Your Honor. The trial judge abused her discretion in this case because she viewed the October 2019 search from a grudging and negative position because of what happened in February 2019. The United States asks this court to uphold the Supreme Court's reminder from Illinois versus Gates that grudging and negative attitudes by courts towards warrants is inconsistent with the Fourth Amendment's strong preference for searches conducted pursuant to a warrant. And we ask this court to find appellee's DNA is admissible, and the military judge abused her discretion. Thank you.
Counsel, thank you both for your arguments. The court will render a decision in due course. The court is now closed.
All rise.